Okay, let's get started. So this is an operating systems class, and I'm aware that you are required to take it. And some of you may want to, some of you don't want to. Once upon a time, it was not a required class. Things worked a little better because folks who are interested in operating systems came to this class. Now you have to. Now, should you have to? That's not something I need to worry about. That was decided because as a computer science graduate, you're supposed to know something about how operating systems work. Whether that's true or not is not up to me. And one of the reasons why this class is not very well liked is because a lot of you are really not that interested in operating systems. Your career will take you to graphics, AI, web systems, system administration, IT, a lot of things that does not require an in-depth knowledge of operating systems, which is what we try to do here. Okay? So I'm on both sides of the fence. I think it should be required, and I also see that why it may not be as required as it should be. Anyway, so it's an operating systems class. Being the first class, I'm not going to get into any major technical topic. I'll give you an overview of what the class is about. Positives and negatives, grading, assignments, homeworks, policies, communication strategies, all that kind of meta information about the class. And hopefully if you have questions at all, we will take up the period. If not, we don't. Okay? Before we get started, what is an operating system? Sounds like a dumb question. What is an operating system?
System software.
It's system software. Now we'll start about what is system software. Whatever you answer, it'll be both correct as well as not correct. So silliness is it's a system that operates. One definition that used to be very popular in the media once upon a time, I kind of still remember it. Machine computer. System that operates is a joke. Low-level software that controls the inner workings of a machine is remarkably accurate and remarkably useless. What does it mean? What's a low-level software? Do software have levels? What does it control? What's these mysterious inner workings of a machine? Is a computer a complicated thing? No. It's very, very simple stuff. What is a computer? Well, it has a CPU, it has ALU, it has pipelining, it has all this fancy stuff. But really, it is a logic circuit. It is a circuit that's made out of just a bunch of NAND gates. There's nothing but a NAND gate inside a computer. Lots of them. All statically wired. The connections don't change. So how hard can it be? But that's where it starts. So one of the most important things that you need to know to kind of understand what goes on in this class is another not very well liked class called 230. Been there? Do you care for it? That pretty much determines whether you like this class or not. That's where we start, 230. What's an interrupt? How does this thing work? Now, interrupt is something that can be considered an inner working of a machine because you don't see it as a user. An operating system today seems to be that thing that draws all the beautiful icons on the screen, and when you click on it, instead of just opening, it opens and it fades. And no, that's not operating systems. That's your graphical user interface, but how good an operating system looks, or the Android phones look, or the iOS phones look, seems to be more important than what's inside it. So this class is about what's inside it. And that too, we're not going to cover how it really works. You will not be operating systems experts who can reconfigure an operating system, write the device drivers, install stuff. That's IT. It is much more targeted to the concepts of something boring like CPU scheduling. What is CPU scheduling? Okay, we will spend quite a bit of time talking about CPU scheduling, memory management, concurrency, interrupt handling, system calls. These are little artifacts, algorithms, and stuff. Some of it is a little bit of math, not much. But how does the concepts work? Scheduling is a huge part of operating systems, but as a user, you don't see anything to do with scheduling, whatever it is. Okay. Operating systems are also sometimes called resource managers. Again, the correct term, but then you wonder what's a resource and what's there to manage. We know, like, if you've got a bunch of people, you may have to manage it. But inside this computer, what's a resource? And well, resource is the amount of CPU time allocated to a process. A resource is the amount of memory or disk or things that have to be used on an exclusive basis. And how do we reallocate? And is it all algorithms? Yes, it is all algorithms. Is it complex algorithms? No, they'd better be constant time algorithms. A linear algorithm is too slow to be used in operating systems. So all constant time algorithms. Okay? Okay, we'll leave it at that. So what's this, how do we structure this class? This is right now this is the only class I'm teaching that has a textbook that I will follow. I haven't read it in a while, but the textbook is Operating Systems Concepts, I believe, by Schilberschatz and so on. How do you get this textbook? Do you have to buy it? Can you use an older edition? Okay, all of it is a moot point. I think it's included as part of your course fee, so you don't have a choice. You've already bought it.
I've already tried to access it on Blackboard. You can't actually access it.
You cannot?
No. Yeah. It says there's like a reference error.
Yeah. What does it say? I can't read it. Okay, so I don't know if things have changed. If it's not part of the class, then it's up to you to buy it, not buy it, get an older edition. Older edition is just as good. They have to keep on upgrading it, which adds fluff at the end, not really in the meat. Operating systems is a very old subject. It's definitely 50 plus years old, and nothing much has changed. You kidding me? Nothing has changed in operating systems? Nothing much has changed. It's gotten glossier, faster, Windows 10 or iOS, whatever, and Android versions. Now, internally, the concepts, nothing much has changed. So older editions are fine. They sell for around $10. And you probably do need a reference textbook. But it's up to you. I will not force you to buy it. But if it's there on the Blackboard, okay, I'm coming to Blackboard. What I was told, maybe things have changed since the, or maybe they'll, there's a tab in there called Contents, and that has this book, and obviously you people looked at it and you found there were pictures of the book, but there's nothing in it. So I don't know the story. Check with, okay, I'll check. And maybe they've yanked the contract or something. Don't know. So it's an expensive book. You're welcome to buy the book, or you can look for used editions or whichever way you go. In addition, I get laughed at for saying Wikipedia is a good source, but it is. And it is because I use it very heavily to learn stuff. And whenever, if you want to go outside the textbook, which is a good idea, all the terms that you hear in class, I just said CPU scheduling, and there'll be memory management and resources and all this, just go and look at Wikipedia on the, or Google. If you do it under Google, it'll refer you to Wikipedia and various other things. So there's a huge amount of useful resources out there on the web that I would encourage you to use if you don't understand something, especially when you get into semaphores and concurrent programming and race conditions and things like that. It does get, there is a part of this class which I'll explain today that gets quite difficult. Sorry, it is. At least to learn. Once you get the hang of it, it's not that bad. But semaphores and stuff, concurrency problems, are difficult. Since I mentioned it, concurrent programming is, you must have heard about parallel programming, which is an important topic. Concurrent programming is the hard part of parallel programming. Parallel programming isn't that hard. What's hard is the much more complex parallelism that does not occur in parallel programming because it's application it is done in the application domain. In the system domain, inside an operating system kernel, all these problems happen, and it's important to understand how to control the behavior of multiple computations running at the same time on the same piece of memory, trampling over each other. And that gets pretty hairy. So that will be quite a bit of this class. What has this got to do with operating systems? Operating systems is the place where this happens on a regular basis. This stuff was invented in the, or looked at and worked on in the 70s. And it's the same thing still. But the understanding of concurrent programming is something that's not very common, and we want you all to know about it. Okay? That's pretty much one of the takeaways of this class, and it's the hardest one. Okay, I do use a web page, not Blackboard, personal choice, and you will find most everything that you need for this class there. To get to it, you can bookmark it or whatever, but if you don't have it handy, what you can do is you may have to remember at least my first name or my last name. And do I look like that? Maybe. This one. And under here, there is a link for operating systems. So, this is a skeleton now because the class hasn't really happened, but the class resources will be here. But what we have here is that the midterm exam is on March 13th. Now, make sure you have that date marked so that you're not out of town. It is right after spring break. Don't extend your spring break. If you miss that, you're going to be in a little bit of a bad situation. exams are fixed, not movable, and the only way you can get away not attending an exam is if there's a serious problem like a medical emergency. Those things are. The final exam will happen in two parts. It is the same exam, it's not two exams. It is the same exam where we will split it up into two parts for some logistic reasons of getting the grades done in time. That is, we can get the part of the grades done and then add more, because it's pretty close to the grading deadline out there, and it's a large class, so it'll need. But anyway, so the April 26th will be, half the exam will be handed out on April 26th, the other half will be on May 3rd. Okay? Instead of one exam altogether. There is a material here on course policies, syllabus, course descriptions, and all that. You can take a look at that. I'll talk about grading in a minute. One of the important links here is something called class synopsis, which has nothing right now. This is where I will be posting all the notes that I write down in class. So since it's on a computer, I can just PDF in and post it there. And most of the time, I will post an audio recording of the class. The only reason why the audio recording might be missing is because I forgot to record it or something like that, in which case it's not recoverable. So I will try to be on top of that and have audio recordings posted, as well as a general outline of what the major topics that were covered. Okay. So right now this is not interesting, but you will find it interesting or useful later. Another important item is this discussion group, which is a Google Groups forum, and this is full of stuff from prior offerings of the class. So if you want to go look at it, that's fine. It has most of these topics are about Project 4 or something like that, but there is more about it. So it's just group discussions on topics that are interesting or have questions. Now, my primary goal in having this, okay, it's called CSE 430 because this class used to be called CSE 430. Now it's 330. So this is from a long time back. My goal in having this is as follows. You will have questions for me for whatever reason. Instead of sending me email, put it here. Why not send me email? Now, if it's a personal matter, send me email. There's no reason to go public. This is a public group. If it's not a person, it's a question about a class, about a topic's not clear, this project is whatever, etc., post it there, because other people will have the same question. Some of them will again duplicate the question sent to me, or they will not know the answers to those questions. So post it publicly, I will answer it. I get an email anytime anybody posts there, so I'll be informed about it. Turnaround time is the same whether you send me an email or post it there. If you send me an email, I will reply on this group. That way, the question goes out to everybody. But I prefer that you post it here. So use it. It's a good way of knowing what's going on, what other people's problems are, or what questions have been answered. Project-related stuff, I will post things like put up a project and all that kind of stuff. So there will be, four projects for this class. They will be, the projects will be posted on the main web page. So you'll see entries pop up of the projects. Exams are open book, open notes. Oh, there's final grades? No, there isn't any. Okay, so a little bit about grading. The The grading criteria is reasonably straightforward. That is, you will be given assigned scores, weighted scores for assignment, midterm, and final. Standard. So whatever you get on these three things will be weighted by the appropriate weight, finally summed up into one number, and that will be your course grade. From that, I'll have to figure out what's an A, what's a B, what's a C. And typically what I do is more or less one-third, one-third, one-third. So everybody is ranked. The higher one-third of the class gets an A, rest is B, followed by the C. Is it possible? Does that mean there's nobody below a C? Not true. If there is reason, that is, the grades are much lower than the band, which is C, then you might end up with a grade lower than C. But hopefully you won't go there. Okay? I have thought about many times of doing plus-minus grading. You may disagree, but it's neither beneficial for the instructor or for the students. And like, what if I get a B-plus instead of a B? You could have gotten a B-minus, too. So, and if you look at the distributions, there's probably more of B-minuses than B-pluses, so it's not really a lot of benefit statistically. And the reason for clumping grades together, otherwise it could have been just raw scores, is an old philosophy that if somebody gets a 70% and somebody gets a 75, it's not that much really qualitatively difference. They should be in the same band. That's where it comes from. Let me see if I have a grade sheet somewhere. Okay, so this is finally what a grade sheet looks like. Well, 2016. Okay, so that's from a little bit back. So this is the score I'm talking about, which will be sorted and ranked. And yes, you will have this grade sheet posted on the web so that you can take a look at your scores. And these things called the cutoffs, that means greater than 68 was an A. How did I determine 68? Is that, that's not an A. Well, yes, that's where about one-third of the class ended. So if the scores on exams are low, it doesn't matter. It self-adjusts. Got it? So if you got more than 68 in this class, you got an A. And C and D, so you got 40. There wasn't much below 40. There was no D. There were six E's because, you know, there's no final for this person, no projects, so yeah. But 27 people got an A, 22 got a B, 12 got... So there's more A's than anything. So this is called grade inflation, by the way. Of course, we could just take it all the way and just... It'll make my life so much simpler. Give everybody an A. Don't worry about it. Why don't I go there? I would love to. I'll get into trouble. These things are monitored. Why? The reputation of the school and your jobs depend on grading. If everybody gets an A in almost every class, it's a joke. Okay? So we are entrusted to do this. Give poor grades to certain people. It's not like we are sadists, but we have to do this. So if we look at the grade sheet, yeah, there's a lot of A's. And pretty much that's what's going to end up happening. Okay? But notice things like this happen too. That person got an 82 on the midterm, which is a high grade, but ended up with a B because somehow the final grades were terrible. Another thing to take away is It's not very apparent on this sheet because, okay, let's take a look up there. Another thing is that, okay, this project or whatever was greater than 10, this was 30, this was 10, and for some reason that was 8, which is why. But if you look at the averages for the projects, they're very high. Okay? They're pretty much close to the max points. What does that mean? No. Remind me to talk about extra credit. Because, let's talk about this. Extra credit would be I start handing out 12 out of 10 for good work. Okay? Is that really extra credit? There's no such thing as extra credit. If I start giving out 12 out of 10 to people, then it means that project is graded out of 12, not out of 10. Okay? So anyway, there's nobody getting more than the max. That's the max. So why, if everybody is getting close to the max, what's the repercussion? What does it really mean? It means everybody does well or they cheat. But no, that's not what I that's not what I'm getting at. What I'm getting at is the project grades do not determine the final grade. Right? They kind of, everybody is the same here. It's the differentiation in the exams that causes the grades to be different. Another thing is that it also means that if you do poorly or don't hand in projects, you take a hit. So projects can hurt you. It will not really benefit you. Sad, but that's math. I can't do anything about it. Okay. So it's based off of the curving of the grade is really just where's the average, where's the certain bands of performance, and the project grades are there, very, very important, and yet getting 100% all the projects that does not guarantee you a grade of A. It's really that's how the math works here. Any questions about this? So yeah, that's the inner workings of grading. How were the grades assigned actually? Well, somebody manually looked at papers, had a rubric, and assigned points for various answers. Oh. That's a low. Anyway, so this is the results of the surveys you fill out. You know about this. Seen one? Okay. So it's confidential, but whatever. A lot of it is not nice. It's actually, okay, one thing I'll point out, so you see that response of 17 over 68? That's low. Okay? So, I think you get a lot of emails saying, please respond, and nobody cares. So these are only the people who cared, positively or negatively. So it's not a good sampling, but here's what came out of it. So these things do get to the instructors and the higher-ups, and all kinds of fancy things happen after that. So it's probably a good idea to fill these out, but it's anonymous for you. Not really. Why did I say not really?
Because you're showing us?
No, I'm not showing you names here.
because you know who hates you and who doesn't?
No. Well, it's a more finer point. It is really, I don't know who gave me a very good and a poor. No, I don't. However, somebody does. Unlike the old school paper-based forms that we had, you know, in the Dark Ages. But now that we are no longer in the Dark Ages, it's electronic. That means it is tied to your ASU ID. It is very easy to trace back, not for me. But if you put in death threats, sure, you'll be found. So it's not quite technically anonymous, but it's anonymous to me, as long as you know that. So just going over this quickly, textbook supplementary material. So this is what the prior class was. The past sometimes predicts the future. Assigned homework, so you just have to look at the count or the percentage field here to get a feeling. Value of lab assignments, pretty much all over the place, but the number of people responding is very poor, actually. Reasonableness of exams and quizzes, weight given to labs and projects and whatever the weight, the projects and projects does not, labs and projects, the weight given is not that relevant other than it is there to make sure you do it so that you do learn something. Weight given to homework assignments. Definition and application for criteria of grading. I just did that. We will not revisit that topic. There is no extra credit. It's based on a mathematical formula. There'll be about third, or not really, if I get a little more generous than that. And that's the definition and application of the grading criteria. Then there is questions about what the instructor was like. Was he prepared? Could he communicate? Seems relatively okay so far. Overall rating, 4, which is not too bad. How would you rate yourself as a student in the class? 8 people said good, and 9 said excellent to very good. Is it a required course? Yes. How long did you spend studying? I didn't, so you can just decide whether these make sense to you or not. That's what's reported by your peers. Average hours per week spent studying for the class. What's your class standing? Senior, some juniors, some grad students. Okay. What number of class meetings you've attended? All. Okay. The free form ones are all over the place. This is where the good comments and the bad comments are, the juicy stuff. So this is like, say something good about the class. So all these comments have to be good. Textbook was good. So that pretty much says it's wonderful. For the opposite point of view, we scroll down a little.
Last semester.
In what building?
This was about two semesters back. Wexler Hall, where did you see that?
Yeah.
Oh, lecture hall.
Yeah.
This class was taught, I think, like SLS, what is SLS? Language or something. Yeah, it was a 200 plus capacity classroom, and it was 60 something students, not 30, but 30 used to show up or something like that. So he's pretty poor at teaching, yeah. Okay, figure it out, Google it. Maybe I did say that. You will get those answers if it's something that gives away the, you know, the question. Or so yeah, the instructor is not very cool. One had no complaints. There's some entertainment and some truth to this, but that's called real life. So, and as far as turning up the microphone, if you can't hear me, tell me. Actually, is the microphone, does it work?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so that is more than you need to know. Yeah, I almost forgot about recitations, but I noticed that was on the comments. So there are three recitations you're signed up for, one. And, okay, so you have to attend it. Do you have to attend class? Whichever class, recitation or lecture. As far as I know, class attendance is mandatory. I do not take attendance, it's too much trouble. But you're adults. If you choose not to come to class, that's your choice. I would strongly suggest that you do come to class. I know there is a correlation between grades and class attendance, although I cannot prove it because there's no paper trail of it. The recitation attendance is an attendance sheet. It is done by a TA who has been assigned to do the recitations, and he will... Has anybody been to one yet? Okay, so you've got the hang of the person and the... He's obviously got nothing to talk about this week because nothing has been covered yet. But so he's struggling through figuring out how to spend the 50 minutes because each class has to be staffed and attended. Okay. So what's the recitation for? I don't know. I've never attended one. No, I'm serious. As a student either. So, didn't have any. But it's a discussion class to talk about, ask questions about things that have been covered in class and you're not sure about, or go over it again. Tell me more about it. It also depends upon the person running the recitation, who's a new student, and I don't know him well, but he seems to be capable. That's all I can say. Okay? This thing is too short. I could put it there, but... Okay, what did we talk about? Any questions? Let's do questions. Yeah.
So if we have recitation today, we should just go to it?
There's no... I think the next recitation is Wednesday. Oh, there's one today? Well, you're supposed to go to it. If I tell you don't go to it, I'm violating ASU policy. It's a scheduled class. And yes, the recitation person will be there. So it's only Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday? I thought there was a Thursday. There's one on Thursday. There was one on Monday. There's one on Wednesday. So there's nothing today. Oh, there's four recitations? Okay, I don't remember. Whatever you signed up for. Yeah.
There's a note on your website that says programming projects need to be done in groups of two.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
Yes,
there will be programming projects. On each project, there needs to be two names on it. But you'll submit the same thing. No, you don't. You submit one, not two, with two names on it. Both people will get the same credit for that. Okay? So it's a program that you will email in. So what is this programming project? It is a project that teaches you a little bit about how to write an operating system scheduler which runs multiple programs or processes all at the same time and does things with coordinating them. It is much simpler than I'm kind of hyping it out to be. So it is a complex end product that actually is quite simple to program. So you will do it in various pieces. And each piece is a separate project, but it's cumulative, that is, one piece is built on another. And it's written in C, you can choose C++, don't ask for Java, Python, etc. Operating systems are not written in higher level languages. There are reasons for that. And what? So, groups of two means... Now, is it possible to always have groups of two? Will I deduct points, etc.? To an extent, I will penalize if you're not in a group. How do you get a partner if you don't know anybody? Well, in class, in real life, on the discussion board, and if a few people don't have partners, then we will ignore it and say, you and you figure it out. Okay? But if a lot of you don't have partners, then there'll be some penalties for that. We want group projects. Any more questions?
Do you offer honors contracts?
Yeah. We could do that.
Yeah, about the textbook access on Blackboard, did you intentionally pick them up out here?
It's not up to me. It's a complete mystery to me how it appears there and whether you do get charged or not. I was told that everybody pays and it's out there. Maybe that has changed. So I will try and find out, and if it's not there, then you have not been checked. I don't know the answer to that. Any more? Thank you. I don't need to talk about prerequisites. You're all ASU students. Your prerequisites have been checked. It's about, I don't even remember, 230, 310, something else probably, programming. Programming, data structures, organization. Those are the prereqs for this course. It's a system level course. But from this class 230, the fetch execute cycle and how memory is accessed and the addressing and the interrupt handling is very important. I will go and cover some of it a little bit, but much faster. What's the story here? What's so great about fetch and execute? All software, regardless of what you've heard in 230, are treated, all software treats the CPU as a single cycle CPU. Always. You know what a single cycle CPU is. Everybody looks like they've never heard of 230. What is a single cycle CPU?
Fetch and execute.
Each thing is a cycle and is done in one clock cycle. That's not true. There's pipelining, there's all kinds of stuff. But that is what the model that the software sees. Anything else is hanky-panky that goes on in the hardware. The software doesn't see it. The software doesn't see pipelining. The software doesn't see caching. The software doesn't see some other bizarre stuff that's going on. For example, you hear about the meltdown bug or whatever. That's reasonably invisible to software, other than through timing attacks. Anyway. So since it's doing fetch and execute, one takeaway definitely is that any modification, arithmetic, does not happen in memory. It happens on the CPU. The memory is accessed only in terms of read and write. This is very important for this class, that memory values are read and written. You do not add, you do not increment memory. Really? Yeah, you don't. You read a value, you add it to one in your scratchpad register, and then push it out. Why is it important? You'll see in concurrency. It makes a major difference whether you can do it in memory or do it in CPU. It's always done inside the CPU. So that's important. How is memory organized, those addresses? How do caches work is less important, but I want you to know how caches work. Interrupt handling. All the thing about jumping to interrupt vector, running to somewhere else, that the interrupts is what makes an operating system work. An operating system, another view of an operating system, it's just one interrupt handler. That's all that an entire huge operating system is, one interrupt handler. So it's a resource manager, it's an interrupt handler. And these interrupts are happening asynchronously as well as synchronously in the program. And there is a bunch of software that you don't see, which we call the kernel, that is fielding all the interrupts and executing them. Whether it's a single CPU system or multi-CPU system, it's all the same thing. There's a huge bunch of concurrent stuff going on in the kernel. And that's what we'll have to unravel slowly. Okay? So the prerequisites is interrupt handling, memory, and fetch and execute. How does the CPU work? Okay. I will go with the kind of the book organization on the topics of operating systems. Let me quickly give you a glimpse of what we are going to cover. Some time will be spent on background. Background means let's start from the days of old when operating systems haven't been invented. Why do we need operating systems? A computer is this CPU, which is a bunch of NAND gates, and memory, which is a bunch of flip-flops, and flip-flops are NAND gates anyway. And that's all you need. You can load a program in there, it'll work. No, we don't want to do it that way. We want to add on a bunch of overhead that messes with the system and makes it run slower, called the operating system. Why would we want that? So we'll look into, like, what's a primitive operating system? What's a little bit more? And the modern operating systems are really quite primitive. They're 1970s operating systems. They have 70s had all this stuff about virtual memory and concurrency and all that things. But how did it evolve? Why did it evolve? What's the necessity of this thing? And kind of how it works. And the moment we talk about the need for operating systems, we'll drop down into, well, it's a piece of software. Who calls it? When does it run? How does it do its job? Through interrupt system calls and an underlying thing called protection. So that's the nuts and bolts of it. So how does all that fit together is the next topic. Once we figured that out, we'll go to somewhat of a theoretical topic called CPU scheduling. Computers don't work by doing one thing at a time. I mean, they do work. One thing at a time is one job to completion, then another one to completion. It mixes the whole thing up and does little bits of all kinds of stuff. So who decides what and how much little bits of which the CPU should be doing at what point in time? And that decision maker is the CPU scheduler. Every operating system, if an operating system doesn't have a CPU scheduler, it's not an operating system. So I could say DOS is not an operating system because it doesn't have a CPU scheduler. You're not familiar with DOS. That's the old prehistoric Windows, anyway. So it has to be a multitasking system. There are reasons why it's multitasking, that you can do multiple things at the same time. And this thing about moving from one to the other uses a mechanism called context switching and triggered by decision points of when do I need to abandon this and move on to the other. And the simplest answer would be time slicing. Give it a little bit of time, move on to the other. That's not the best answer. So what's the pros and cons? There is no single good answer to this problem. There are, every attempt has its pluses and minuses. So finally, what do we have on these computers? If it's a desktop, it uses a slightly different algorithm than a server. And the only difference between server versions of the operating system and the desktop versions of the operating system is, one part of it is slightly different graphical user interface. Main difference is CPU scheduling algorithms. That's all. It's the same thing with tweaks on how the CPU scheduler works. So we'll talk about CPU scheduling and its various ramifications. Then, now that we talked about the fact that the CPU, typically we will consider the computer to be a single CPU, although all computers are not single CPU today, but it makes it a little simpler to say, just say it's a single CPU. The difference between a single CPU and a multiple CPU is strangely hardly much. There are some key differences, I'll point that out, but in terms of understanding and concepts, there's really not much of a difference. Then we'll talk about processor threads and concurrency. Now that we have the ability to take a bunch of activities, programs, and make them all run at the same time under one CPU, how do we program this if they are threads? that is, they interact with each other. And that's the dance of race conditions and concurrency. And we will get stuck with this for quite a long time. So some of you will find it boring that we are just constantly talking about these threads and how they are behaving and how to control their behavior. But that's the intellectually challenging part of the class. And concurrency is very important. All programs today have threading. All processors today are multi-core. So concurrency is at the forefront of writing programs, be it at the kernel level or be it at the applications level. So we spend... Now, why is why do I keep saying concurrency is hard? All of you have written programs that are sequential, right? A C program, a Java program, a Python program. They execute one line of code one after the other. And the biggest problem there is that we still can't get it right. Writing a correct program is hard because we are humans. We don't think that logically. So it has been a struggle forever of getting human beings to write programs, sequential programs, correctly. Now we come ahead and say that the programs are not sequential. They execute random instructions in some uncontrolled fashion that you cannot even control. It's based on a CPU scheduling algorithm that you can't touch. Now you're in real deep trouble. How do you handle that? So yes, there is a set of maxims to do that, but it's not easy. It's much, much harder than writing a sequential program. And people have worked hard on making it simpler using constructs like monitors and semaphores and things like that to control the behavior of these things. But we are in an operating systems class. We'll say nothing exists. We have to build our own tools and make these programs work properly. And it gets a little hairy out there. I mean, it's just... So it's a good skill to know about. That's my feeling. I'm excited. Some of you are like, how does it help web design? I'm not sure. Maybe it doesn't. Memory management is another topic that we'll spend some time on. It is not terribly well understood area because memory management is something that really goes under the covers in a computer operating system. And as a programmer, you see none of this. As far as any application programs concerned, there is no memory management. You may say, but what about dynamic memory allocation, malloc, new, that kind of stuff? That's not memory management. How malloc and new works, it's kind of a sugar coating. The operating system gives you a bunch of memory, fixed, standard, and the unallocated memory is already pre-allocated. And malloc and new just move some pointers around to pretend that this memory is unallocated and we'll give you new memory. It's smoke and mirrors. How does the operating system give you memory and arrange it in RAM with the help of hardware is this topic. So the teaser is that in a 32-bit system, each process is pre-allocated 2 gigabytes of memory. Excellent memory model, 3 gigabytes in Linux. Doesn't matter. Let's go with 2 gigabytes of memory. Every process gets 2 gigabytes of memory. In a normal idle computer, how many processes are there?
A lot.
A lot. 100? More. So we have farmed out 200 gigabytes of memory to processes. Nobody has 200 gigabytes of memory. In fact, the physical limitation on the amount of memory you can physically put into a machine on a 32-bit machine is 3 gigabytes. You can put it in more, they'll just lie idle. Nobody is going to use it. Only 3 gigabytes can be used. So you may want to put in 3 gigabytes. You may want to put in less. It doesn't matter. Hundreds of gigabytes of memory will be pre-allocated to processors. Where is this mystery? How does that happen? That's what memory management is about. Building this smoke and mirrors game of every process not only gets 2 gigabytes, what's the address space? Starts at 0, ends at 2 gigabytes. For everyone? Yes, for everyone. Well, then two processors are using the same addresses. Yes, but it's not the same memory. The RAM and these numbers are completely, there's a huge disconnect here. And that's called virtual memory and memory mapping and page tables and all that. That gets a little difficult, but it's there in every piece of hardware, including your little cell phone. It's built into every CPU today. So we need to know about that. And by this time, once we get there, the course will be towards an end. So there are two other topics which will be rushed through: file systems, which is quite important, but not as important as file systems you know about. You see it all day. There are files in directories, but basically how does it work? And device management. Which will boil down to disk head scheduling. Which is not terribly important in little desktop systems, but in servers, disk head scheduling is important. It enhances speed. How do you move the disk heads at what point in time and where to handle the best throughput on I/O? And that's pretty much what the course is like. Okay? So notice I didn't talk about device drivers, I didn't talk about programming an operating system, I didn't talk about configuration files, I didn't talk about shell programming. There's a lot of things left out. What about networks? No, not part of this class. Okay, I'll take questions. Projects are on building a scheduler and writing concurrent programs. And it'll be 4 projects, one built on top of the other. That is, you have to finish one to do the other because you'll reuse code.
I don't remember. Did you mention the program that we would want to be using in this class, like something like C or
C++. I would push C, but it's okay if you use C++.
Sorry, some of our professors have been very specific about how we program. Is it all right if we use Visual Studios and the shared header files and that sort of deal?
No, this is, it'll be on Linux. So the question was, is it okay if you use, Visual Studio and shared network files?
Shared header files.
Shared header files. The header files, etc., will be minimal. It will be specified. You're probably best off with VI or Emacs on Linux. But if you have some kind of a, what are those things called? The
IDE.
Or Visual Studio stuff. What is it? What's the one on Linux? Eclipse or something like that.
It's Eclipse.
Yeah. That's okay. It'll be just straight C files. You'll submit a .c file and a .h file, or C++. You know, it's pretty low level because we are in a low level class. There's no tools that you can. We'll get into that. I mean, you got to build something that we will mimic that we are building an operating system. We are not. We're just building an application program. But let's just see how we can run threads.
So are we going to be using like a VM to set up the Linux, or do we need like a Linux?
No, you can use a VM.
Okay.
I mean, the code will be written for Linux. Now, how do you run Linux? On a bare machine or VM? Doesn't matter. That's really up to the person. I don't generally care, but I would say what.
Probably fine, but I'll ask him.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We all go together.
Hey, for the honors contracts, I have an interest in purely functional operating systems. I don't know anything about them.
I don't know anything about them either.
There, do you think I could do something related to that for my project?
I don't know what it would be, maybe like a research paper about what.
Provided there is such a thing.
There is. They have done like five, I just looked it up in class, they've done like five PhD dissertations on it, and there are a couple real world examples of using it.
Okay, maybe it's good for me to know too.
Okay. So would that just be something like a
survey
paper or something?
Yeah, it'll be like just kind of a write-up on what these things are, what's going on, why.
Is it about the honors project?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah, I was kind of wondering about what we should, like what the kind of guidelines were for the class.
Something more than in the class, and that's completely open. You can take the project and extend it. You can. He's talking about researching something called functional operating systems.
Okay.
You can pick a topic and do some work on it to gain some knowledge, or actually to programming, whichever. So.
Yeah. All right. Thanks.
Yeah, so what I was thinking was just reading those grad level.
So I guess you're supposed to kind of write up something before you. So write a summary of what you're going to do. I'll take a look at it and we'll go from there.
Okay. Yeah, I was just thinking like a survey paper, maybe a couple pages.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, great.
Did you post something, anything to the backlog? Because I didn't try anything to the backlog.
To what?
Yeah,
the syllabus is there. There's a web page there. Look for my name on the web. You'll find everything about this class.
Because I opened the blackboard and there's nothing.
Blackboard, there's nothing. There's web pages for the class. Use Google to find it.
Yes, so about the textbook, do we need it?
It's up to you to decide. I will be following the textbook. It's not here. Google search my name, Partha, P-A-R-T-H-A.
Okay. I think you should get Windows 10 on here.
What did I say, Windows 10? What? I said Windows... No. This one?
Yeah. And
this one?
Yeah. And then this 330.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did you put, textbook on Blackboard, or did someone else?
Okay, textbook on Blackboard. I don't know if it's there. It may or may not be there, or maybe that was last semester, and this semester it's not there. I don't put it. It's automatically put or not put. So that's something. I just don't know the answer to that. No. But if you want to get a copy of the textbook, that's up to you.
Thank you.
Wait,
what was with those textbook links on your Blackboard page?
I saw some textbook links and they don't work, so I don't know what's the problem. I didn't put it there.
But that's a required textbook, right?
That's a required textbook. Required? Yeah, it's required. But if you don't have it, nobody's coming after you.
Okay. Syllabus is on your website, right?
Hmm?
Syllabus.
Yeah, syllabus is on the website. Oh, syllabus is also on the... It's on the website. It's also on that ASU registration site. There's a syllabus.
Oh.
Thank you.